This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. Today we're talking about Indiana Avenue in Indianapolis, its vibrant history, its lost culture, and how organizations and historians are trying to keep this historic part of downtown alive. If you have questions or comments on our show today, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. And you can also send us high-quality voice messages with our smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. It's free and easy to use. You just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Today, we're joined by two guests. Our first guest is Jordan Ryan, an Indianapolis-based architectural historian and archivist. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, Taylor. Thanks for having me today.
Absolutely. We also have Paul Mullins, an author and a professor of anthropology at IUPUI. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both for being here today. Paul, before we get to recent published work by you and Jordan, can you give us a little bit of a brief history of Indiana Avenue? I would love to know what that area that's so rich in history was like, say, 100 years ago.
Well, when Europeans arrived here and laid out the mile square, they put four spokes off of the central circle. And the northwest spoke is, of course, Indiana Avenue. And by about 170 years ago, in the late 1840s, early 1850s, this kind of rudimentary dirt path that Indiana Avenue was a avenue linking mostly rural farmers to the city. They would come in and out of the city from places like Pike Township, Brownsburg, Zionsville, in and out along Indiana Avenue. So in what's now the 800 and 900 block of the avenue, there are businesses like blacksmiths, craftspeople that were serving that audience, and a handful of groceries. And in the 200 block, which is where the AUL building is eventually built, in that block closest to the circle, a handful of business had began to arise in the 1840s and 1850s. There are African-Americans among these businesses from at least 1850, but they will not become predominant until the avenue becomes segregated. The city becomes segregated in about 1900 very, very rapidly. And that association that we have of the avenue with an African-American segregated community really begins at the turn of the century.
And it began to be a place where everybody went, right? It was very vibrant. It had a lot of things going on, a lot of storefronts, and rich in music.
Yeah, it's a very typical segregated business and leisure community surrounded by black residential, much as we would see in cities that are segregated either legally or by informal practice. We see that throughout the United States. So we have lots and lots of businesses serving almost every need that a consumer would look for. Restaurants are always the most common business on the avenue, but there are plenty of clubs, often in restaurants that also play music in the evening. Every sort of black expressive culture that we would want to see as an audience was available on the avenue, certainly in the first quarter of the 20th century.
Yeah. What would you compare it to now? Would it be like a Mass Ave type place where there was just one business after another and people would come downtown?
It would be actually a sort of a 24-hour business and leisure district surrounded by residential. So it's a little different from Mass Ave. Mass Ave does have a residential component, certainly, but we would see much, much denser residential housing just instantly, immediately off of the avenue. And some people always living on the avenue over businesses as well. So it's a much more densely populated area than I think. You and I are used to going to Mass Ave, for instance, as a sort of visitation. You know, we go mm-hmm. down, we go to a restaurant, we leave. These are folks who, partly because of segregation, partly because these are the only places that will cater to them, are going to be on the avenue for all their needs.
Jordan, can you talk a little bit about what the architecture of the avenue was like then? and then kind of compare it what it is like now.
Yeah, like Dr. Mullen said, think density, just like you see in Ransom Place today or in similarly sort of platted and sized neighborhoods like Fletcher Place or Cottage Home. You know, the area was built up with mostly uniform blocks of small single family residential structures of housing that was generally built in the 1860s to 1890s, many wood frame 1 and 1.5 story cottages. You know, some people would call these vernacular architecture, which just means simplified or lacking ornamentation, but that isn't always the case. You know, if you look at old photos, you can pick out, you know, ornamented porch trim and window details, you know, modest sort of Victorian era carpentry. Later, you see larger two-story residences. Some of these are duplexes. And then along Indiana Avenue itself, the main commercial corridor, you see predominantly commercial structures, typically brick. They typically range from 1 to 3 stories. So I like to compare it to Virginia Avenue, thinking of a dense and busy street level, you know, lots of activity. And then just off, you know, the avenue, you have a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. The difference today is that many of these historic structures have been demolished. And in their place, we see larger postmodern structures and a lot of parking lots.
So not a lot of those neighborhoods are left that was once there.
Yeah, we've lost a lot of the historic neighborhood.
One thing that is there that is kind of a reminder is the Madam Walker Theater, that what parts of the avenue can be seen today as it was several decades ago like that, like the Madam Walker Theater. Is that still a kind of a central part of a reminder of what it used to be?
Absolutely. The Walker Theater building is a great example of both a preservation project that will hopefully serve the community, but also is a reminder of what the rich sort of cultural heritage of the neighborhood and that commercial corridor was. And we can sort of use that to be strategic and mindful in how we might redevelop, you know, these parking lots and uninspiring buildings on the avenue today.
Are there any other areas around there or any other structures that is still like it was then besides the theater?
Yeah, we have a few buildings sort of peppered in on the avenue that have been restored or altered significantly, but you can still sort of see the historic features in between. And I would say guesstimate maybe about 15%, just off the top of my head, mm-hmm. has been restored.
You guys, you put together some research I thought was very interesting, you and Jordan, and it really digs deep into what that area was like, the culture of Indiana Avenue, almost 100 years ago. When you put that research together, what were some of the most eye-opening stories that you uncovered, Paul?
Well, I think one of the things that people are often surprised by is that there are African-American businesses very early, certainly by 1850, and they are alongside white enterprises more or less peacefully, really, for the rest of the 19th century. We don't really begin to see an emergence of segregation until the very end of the 19th century, the very beginning of the 20th century. And that kind of spatial segregation that I think many of us associate with Indiana Avenue history, that's really an artifact of a very specific moment when the whole nation really embraces black residential segregation, and we embrace white public space. But, you know, the second half of the 19th century, we have a lot of African-American business people alongside white business people. They're all catering to a relatively mixed audience of working class and genteel people alike.
Now, there were multiple generations of black families there for a long time, correct?
Certainly. The a guy named Thomas Bushrod had a grocery on Indiana Avenue in 1850, rather. And his granddaughter will have a restaurant in the same block at the end of World War II, what was known as Smothers Beanery. So there are some businesses that have enormous stamina that stay on the avenue for a very, very long time.
Right. And it just seemed like they really had that connection to the avenue's schools, you know, the churches, the businesses and all there, they had that connection there. I think that was probably was pretty special about the area at that time.
Certainly.
Yeah. Jordan, what does this work mean to you as a native of Indianapolis when you, you look at this this history and what it's become?
Yeah, this is really about cultural heritage and legacy. The first free Black residents settle in the area just, you know, a decade or so after the white settler squatters moved in and the city is officially established. And there's just so much going on the Near West Side where we have all of these institutions and services that are being provided. You know, there's churches and schools and YMCAs and commerce. And I think about commerce for Black business, you know, it's really about representing hope and opportunity. And as the physical fabric of Indiana Avenue gets chipped away, I think it's symbolic in how that sort of hope and opportunity also get chipped away. So a lot of my work as a historian and architectural archivist has moved in the direction of understanding and critiquing land use and inequity. It's one way I can use my specific skill set to help fight structural racism and to help provide that historic context to advocates who are fighting today for a more equitable future. And that really lights my fire.
Yeah, you do great work in uncovering the history. Do you think there's obviously there's a lot more to be done, but do you think it's challenging to stay on track with that?
Absolutely. There's a lot in the toolbox to preserve what we have left. You know, there's things like federal and local preservation protections. There's individual covenants. There's maintenance and repair funding. There's so much more interpretation and outreach we could be doing, more collecting of archival materials, you know, more education for decision makers. There's just so much to do to sort of move that system towards saving things that perhaps in the past preservationists haven't always focused on. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a lot of resources and staffing needed to make all of this happen.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about what needs to be done to better preserve the history of Indiana Avenue and much more. We'll be right back with our guest after just a quick break. We're talking about the history of Indiana Avenue and how it still impacts Indianapolis. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Taylor Bennett. We'll be right back. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. Now, today we're talking about the legacy of Indiana Avenue in Indianapolis and some new details about its heyday and its transformation over the decades. We'd love your questions and comments on this topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from. That number is 866-476-3881. And don't forget, you can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. You just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or a comment, and we'll try to get it into the show. Now, Paul, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about when you started your initial research on Indiana Avenue and the reactions that you got to it when it was first published.
Well, I started working here in Indianapolis when I came to IUPUI just over 20 years ago. And I mean, I was attracted to the rich history of the Near West Side, and I could see that there was a history to be told of urban renewal and displacement. But I think one of the things that I'm struck by on the Avenue is that there was a relatively shallow understanding of the heritage of the Near West Side and African-American history in Central Indiana in general. So folks had a kind of general idea that there had been jazz music played on the Avenue, and they probably could name Wes Montgomery or Pookie or a handful of other musicians, but knew very, very little about the enormously rich expressive cultural tradition that's on the Avenue for well over a century. And I'm also, I think I've always been struck that there are quite a lot of people that don't understand the depth of racist segregation that's been in this city since the turn of the 20th century. I think we have a tendency to look at ourselves as a northern city with a kind of southern personality. We see ourselves as not being segregated. We are enormously civil, decent people. So we kind of separate ourselves in our imagination from southern segregation, for instance. We separate ourselves from the worst types of anti-Black racism. But all of that stuff happened here in Indiana, and all of that stuff happened up and down the Avenue. The Avenue is in many ways a product and a place that flourishes in the face of all of that structural inequality.
Can you give us some examples of some of that that was experienced on the Avenue that maybe people don't know?
Well, for the interesting thing about the Near West Side is when you look at these neighborhoods that fan off of Indiana Avenue, you can find working class people of the most modest means living alongside PhDs, folks with enormously rich white collar histories, authors who are living alongside manual laborers. That's a product of residential segregation. That is not something that we would see in white Indianapolis at the same moment when class separation on the landscape was much, much more marked. In African American, residential segregation well into the post-war period and really the 1960s ended up placing Black folks who were truly bourgeois, truly well-educated, alongside working-class people. So you have much, much more class complexity, actually, on the Avenue than we would see in many other neighborhoods here in Indianapolis.
Right. Well, I'm sure, like most areas and many cities, they tend to bury that racism that was part of history, was part of there. What was the city's reaction to your research?
Well, I think the city has never completely figured out how to tell the African-American story. I believe on the one hand, as a community across and along the color line, we really thirst for having a conversation about African-American heritage and racism as well, and a measure of reconciliation. The Avenue is a space, despite what it may look like right now, in which we might seek that kind of reconciliation. But the city has never really made very significant moves in that direction. So I think we want to have that conversation. We have just never figured out how to have it. And that's the problem with racism across a half millennium, is that many of us are troubled by it, but we find it so uncomfortable that we can't say it out loud. And so we're not wrestling with these structural issues.
Mm-hmm. Jordan, what have you seen as far as people who may not share and what you have uncovered and the reaction to the Avenue's history?
I agree with Dr. Mullins, but also I would add that sometimes when the city considers, creative solutions, our state government preemptively bans us from enacting it. So things like our inclusionary zoning ban, have a negative impact on what progress we could make as a city.
What is the progress? What can we do?
I definitely think looking at more dense housing options and affordable housing options and finding ways to get people who have been priced out of the housing market to develop equity through home ownership so that we can break the cycle of sort of that generational wealth challenges that certain homeowners have, finding ways to get more people into a system where they can generate wealth and equity for their families. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that has to do with planning and zoning and finding creative solutions that work sort of around state legislation.
Now, Paul, do you think that going back to Indiana Avenue and its glory and its heyday, do you think that we could ever return or have at least what it once was?
Well, I suspect we're never going to have an Indiana Avenue as it once was, kind of in its glory in the interwar period, in the post-war period. But we can nevertheless have a community that is respectful of that deep African American heritage, is respectful of an incredibly rich expressive cultural tradition, You know, there are things we can do to recognize this heritage on the landscape that we really haven't done. They're not really all dramatic transformations.
You know, you talk about people not really, I guess, acknowledging or accepting whatever the word might be about the history. What do you teach your students? What are you telling them about this part of history?
Well, I certainly teach them that structural racism is the foundation of American society. This is not necessarily something that should surprise them. And in fact, I believe that doesn't surprise many of my students. They understand that. However, saying that is a kind of philosophical statement about the whole of American society, but then operationalizing it in your local community and dissecting this specific history that made racism reproduce itself in your place, like Indianapolis and central Indiana, that's a little different. You know, I think that that pushes that kind of broad philosophical recognition of racism down to a nuts and bolts recognition of here's how it was experienced and constructed in my neighborhood, in a history that I am a part of.
When you look at that area and the construction and everything that has gone on, and you look at IUPUI's construction and expansion, what kind of impact did it have on Indiana Avenue and the neighborhoods around it?
Well, the growth of the university clearly is one of the major mechanisms fueling the depopulation of the avenue. I mean, we did not move onto the avenue, literally, but we displaced at least 5,000 households across what is now the university campus. So we clearly displaced much of the community that once upon a time used the avenue for leisure, for shopping, as their social space to go to church. We displaced much of that residential population, and that is one of the things that hastened the decline of the avenue, just as the interstates are being built and displacing people as well. So the avenue really becomes a bit of an artifact by the 1960s and early 1970s.
How can you keep both, though? I mean, when you look at progression, right, when you look at development, how can you keep new development like the university from expanding, but yet still keep the history of the neighborhoods and not lose either one?
Well, in the case of the university, for instance, I believe that every student that's a part of this academic community needs to know our heritage as an institution. And actually, I believe most of my students feel some sense of responsibility and stewardship for that heritage, that we should tell it, that actually we should be proud to tell it, and we should be proud to have descendant community that will in turn share their stories with us. We're not just any business. You know, as an academic community, we actually, I think, should be leading the way. But, you know, very few of my students ever know any of this history. And I think as an institution, you know, that's one of the things that we're trying to step up is that consciousness, a bit of pride in that heritage, and at the same time, a sense of complicity in this breakdown of a community that was hastened by us as an institution.
Do you think they feel that connection?
I think many of my students do, because I think many of my students open their eyes and look around at the world, and they can see that race is part of their lives, regardless of their own individual experiences. So it doesn't come as a shock to them that this has a deep heritage as well. And it doesn't surprise them that many institutions have used their privilege to benefit from racism. So I think they're in the position. I think we have a generation of students that I'm proud to say that I think are willing to begin to do the hard work on the ground.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on the university's work in renovating the Madam Walker Theater?
Well, I think that's, I actually believe that this is a really important and consequential first step. We put a significant amount of funding into the restoration of the building. We are now supporting a scholarship program. However, I would always tell the administrators that I work for and folks in the community, in the descendant community, that this must be part of a broad strategy and a continuing part of our identity. This is just what we do. These have to be the first steps. Reconciliation will not happen through just a couple of programs or just a little bit of funding here and there. This is a long-term change that will last our lives.
You mentioned a scholarship program, though. What's that about?
The scholarship program that was created by the university this year will give up to $15,000 a year scholarships and academic mentoring to students who are descended from families that were displaced by the expansion of the university. And of course, with the 5,000 or so households on campus and in this surrounding neighborhood, we are talking about quite a lot of students who may trace some descent to this neighborhood. And they may not know that history. They may just know it in kind of in very vague sorts of ways. So this is, I think, a potential for us to begin that reconciliation and reparations process.
Yeah, that's a great connection, though, to the area and having that those scholarships. Is that something that's now open, and how do they apply for that?
The scholarship program has started. Actually, mm-hmm. It's on the university webpage. If you when you apply for admission and you go through financial aid and look at all of the scholarship programs, Through Their Eyes scholarships will be one of those programs.
How many scholarships have been awarded?
I don't know. This is the first year they've done it. And actually, I have nothing to do with the scholarship program.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know some of those details, but it's up on the university webpage. And I have some descendant community folks that I work with whose family is now are in the process of applying for these scholarships.
Okay. Jordan, another project that you're working on involves neighborhood redlining. What is that? What is redlining?
Yeah, redlining is one of the many white supremacist planning strategies that are utilized to favor white homebuyers and negatively impact racially oppressed people. I define redlining as a discriminatory practice by which banks, mortgage lenders, and insurance companies refused or limited loans, mortgages, and insurance within specific geographic areas, particularly in older and inner city neighborhoods, to both non-white and or low-income families. And this was done by the guidance of the Federal Housing Administration's Homeowners Loan Corporation. In addition to that, realtors and real estate developers misrepresented markets and discriminated against prospective homebuyers in order to control market values. So the neighborhoods surrounding Indiana Avenue were redlined, and that devalues the land. And once that land is devalued, it's easier for planners, developers, and institutions to justify large-scale planning policies like urban renewal, like downtown highway systems. And the sum of all this damage makes it easy to further justify additional demolition, which will just continue the displacement. So these strategies, you know, combined displace large groups of people, which also makes it hard for the community to advocate for themselves. And then you're sort of up against another challenge. If the community can advocate for themselves, there's still racism and bias that furthers silencing these marginalized communities in the different sort of, you know, regulatory systems we have for remonstrating against different developments or, you know, proposing certain types of housing. So all these things sort of push back and the cycle continues.
How do you tackle that?
That's a really tough question that we're dealing with today. I think as we start to pick apart what hasn't worked and what we could do better, I think a lot of it is providing advocates today who are working on, you know, affordable housing, you know, density, inclusive neighborhoods, things like that. I can provide historic context that maybe has sort of slipped through the cracks. And maybe that context can be used in the advocate's sort of toolbox to, you know, push for certain city ordinances, certain state laws. We just need to all work together to sort of fight this bigger system or machine that is created the situation over the last century.
Right. And I imagine that's happening not just in Indianapolis. I mean, that obviously that can happen anywhere when you have that kind of discrimination in a neighborhood.
Yeah, I think we're in sort of a rude awakening of the last year or so, where a lot of communities and cities are starting to tackle this head on and grapple with how we got here and how can we move forward to a more equitable cities?
You think city officials, local officials, more receptive to helping that?
Oh, absolutely. I'm one of the curriculum developers for the city's upcoming People's Planning Academy, and it's focused entirely on history. And so we're taking little bits of, you know, historic context, different primary sources, and connecting it with today's resources and groups and different civic organizations working on sort of quality of life metrics for the city. And it's really interesting. It'll allow the students to sort of connect the dots and then sort of imagine what they would see for future city planning goals and policies.
Yeah, that'll be very interesting data to take a look at. All right. Well, we'll be right back and we'll continue our conversation after just a quick break. We're talking with Indianapolis historians and their recent published work about the history of Indiana Avenue. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. And you can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. We'll be right back. I'm Taylor Bennett. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. Back now to our discussion on the rise, pinnacle, and transformation of Indiana Avenue. As always, we'd love to hear your questions and comments. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. And you can also leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from. That number is 866-476-3881. I do have to point out the music when we were going into our break. I love that music, Echoes of Indiana Avenue. What'd you both think of that music? Kind of goes to the tradition of the avenue altogether, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
And, you know, that's a big part of that area, as we mentioned before, was how important music was then in the jazz and what that made the neighborhood, I think, at that time.
Yeah, and I think the thing I would say, you know, the thing I think Jordan and I are interested in always telling people is that one of the really exciting things about doing history in and around the avenue is that African-American expressive culture takes an enormously broad range of things. There's music at every level of everyday life. There's church music. The performances that were along the avenue, there were jazz performers, but there's every type of music and performance on any given night. We could see on the same stage some cinema, big show, a drag show, jazz, hard jazz, soft jazz, a variety of forms of music, a comedian would come out. So it's a very, very rich tradition that cuts very deep and outside of simply the lone jazz man hanging over his guitar in a smoke-filled bar.
Right. It'd be great to go back to that time, you know, and kind of live and what it was like. I just think it just sounds so fun.
It's an enormously exciting and cool tradition. I mean, there's a very good reason that elders feel so strongly about the avenue, that their experiences are so tightly wound around the avenue. And it's because it was such a magnetic place and so critical to their experiences.
Do you think, though, that if the city had a commitment to that heritage and to that neighborhood, to the avenue, that we could have preserved it instead of tearing everything down?
Well, I think when urban renewal happened, we didn't have a commitment to that heritage. We may have a commitment to that heritage now. It's somewhat problematic to actually make such a commitment in retrospect, since we've torn down most of the buildings. We did no land use management. There's very little planning that was ever done. Many buildings were simply torn down here in Indianapolis along the avenue, simply to create open space that the city believed developers would rush in and fill with economic investment. And that happens in some places, sometimes successfully, but most of the time it did not. And in fact, in the short run, what happens in much of downtown Indianapolis, we tear down historic structures, pave over the empty lot, turn it into parking, and much of downtown remains parking, surface parking today. You know, we still are wrapped around parking as, you know, that's what these historic spaces look like today. They're open spots.
We have a question from Marilyn on Facebook who asks, is Lockenfield Gardens a part of this history? Remembers when these apartments were empty and boarded up.
Oh, certainly. Lockfield is among the most consequential social spaces on the avenue. There is a sort of historical memory, perhaps, of some people. By the late 1960s, Lockfield had declined significantly. Much of that, though, is because of disinterested management by the city itself. When Lockfield was built, you know, it's one of 52 of these public works projects on the eve of World War II. And it is truly high modernism. It's really well thought out. There are enormously beautiful houses. People that were residents at Lockfield had an enormous commitment to the community, to the material infrastructure. But by the 60s, it had deteriorated significantly. And by that point, IU wanted a piece of the property. The city was glad to see it go. They didn't really want to administer municipal housing anymore. So the caricatures sometimes that are attached to Lockfield are very much unlike, I think, what we hear from elders talk about when they remember Lockfield.
Mm-hmm. Any other neighborhoods like that?
Well, certainly that's true of much of the Near West Side. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the things, I mean, we do, or Jordan and I do oral history, and I think one of the things we hear from elders over and over again is there's a tendency for elders to often push back against shallow stereotypes of the neighborhood. So those kind of quote-unquote slum caricatures, folks are always want to tell they want to tell a honest and sober history, but they also want to celebrate the pieces of their human experience that were meaningful to them and consequential, but haven't become part of the narrative in retrospect.
As time goes on in a neighborhood, like you talked about urban renewal and new buildings come in, old buildings come down, how do highways impact these neighborhoods? Jordan, in some of your research projects, you kind of looked at how highways impact neighborhoods. How did I-70 and 65 construction affect, specifically looking at Indiana Avenue?
The 65-70 inner loop had a damaging effect on all of downtown neighborhoods by, you know, bisecting neighborhoods, cutting others off completely from downtown, limiting access or making it entirely unsafe for pedestrians. That's both a physical and psychological barrier for downtown residents. When you superimpose the redlining map on top of our downtown highway map, you see that the inner loop is almost entirely in the devalued red or hazardous or yellow or definitely declining sections. And that's absolutely by design. And that greater Near West Side area, that community is directly impacted by I-65 coming in. A lot of people were displaced. You know, they were robbed of a fair price for their homes. West Street today is essentially a long exit ramp. Like, have you tried using a crosswalk across West Street? Like, you feel mm-hmm. totally unsafe. You know, there's these, the highway damages connectivity and accessibility today, and that really has a negative impact on the economic opportunity, community development, quality of life metrics. And it's really sad because 50 years after the highway gets built, we're now seeing the state and NDOT double down on this harmful strategy with efforts to rebuild the inner loop in mostly the same way. And we've already sort of lost out on transforming the North Split. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens to the rest of that inner loop system as these negotiations and what sort of mitigation strategies do we have mm-hmm. moving forward. So I encourage all of you listening to check out Rethink 6570 and learn more about better alternative solutions when we're looking at highway redevelopment.
But don't you need highway redevelopment? Don't you need that bigger and system to help get around the city? Or are you just disagreeing with specifically and how it's done?
I disagree specifically with the inner loop section. I understand the why people like highways, particularly moving, you know, in and out of spaces that are far away from each other. You know, we do live in a very spread out city compared to other major U.S. cities. We're not on a large body of water, so we're not, you know, kind of confined. So we are more spread out than other places, and we can't ignore the fact that we are very automobile centric, obviously, here. But I do think that there's always perhaps a more costly, but maybe a more innovative way to do some of these things. You know, we've seen in other cities capping parts of the highway, essentially, you know, tunneling them so that you still have that, you know, connection on the sort of grade level, a boulevard system. You can look into that, but, you know, where it's safer for cyclists and pedestrians, and you can sort of redevelop that space. We've also seen in other cities where they're just entirely taking out small sections of downtown highways and redeveloping that space into more, you know, public use. So there's a lot of different ideas we could play with in the city today, but there's a lot of different powers and forces that may not be interested in that.
Oh, what would you like to see as far as new construction on the avenue?
Not highway construction.
Not highway construction. Well, either one of you, yeah, Jordan.
Well, for Indiana Avenue itself, I would love to see parking lots pulled, removed. You know, all these parking lots really don't help with street activation, right? So I would love to see more pedestrian friendly and accessible spaces, you know, things that the neighborhood wants, both businesses and services, followed by the desires of hospital workers and university students. But I really want to emphasize it needs to start with the neighborhood residents. And architecturally speaking, you know, it's a challenge to design new buildings in a way that references, you know, what the historic context, but you also don't want to overpower those structures. So that's kind of a tension. And of course, you know, any developer is going to tell you that we have to maximize the footprint and build up. But I would argue that they're interested in maximizing their profits. So I do think scale and massing matter when we're looking at, you know, streetscapes. I could go on and on.
The list is never ending. Paul, what about you? What do you think? What would enhance the area right now?
Well, I think we need, on the part of the city and planners, we need a rigorous public consultation process in which public consultation is not an afterthought. You know, I think there has always been a tendency for planners in NDOT or the city or developers to approach a community once they have once the developers have a plan in their head. They're financially very committed to it at that point. And they're also generally in a position where it's very difficult for them to now be flexible. You know, this is not how public consultation works. You know, you work with grassroots community groups from the very beginning. You create allies in the community from the very beginning. Smart developers know how to do that, but that has not really been common practice, certainly in this city, for better than a half century.
Paul, you contributed to a digital history project around Indiana Avenue, and that's going to be launched soon. Is that correct?
I contributed one of the essays to the Encyclopedia of Indianapolis, which is now becoming a digital encyclopedia of Indianapolis. The Polis Center, Beth Van Allen, Dave Bodenhammer, Matt Nolan are working on turning that into a much more publicly accessible document that's a piece of public scholarship that would be online. And I did much of that. I did some of the work on the Indiana Avenue entry, for instance.
What is that going to entail?
I did a relatively inclusive history of the avenue from the indigenous moment onwards, from the 1820s. I'm interested in all of that diversity of places that music was played along the avenue. What does Black expressive culture look like? What does Black commerce look like? What is vice on the avenue? All of the implications of residential segregation. Those are the sorts of things I'm interested in, life along and across the color line here in the Near West Side.
And you can find all that in one place digitally, right?
Well, you will. There will be a small summary essay that will try to at least catch the surface of it. And that's always what a scholar wants to do, is just begin a public conversation and turn this over to community and elder voices who can enrich that story.
When you say elder voices, what are we talking about? Elder voices. What's the age?
Well, I'm getting close to elder voices.
Well, you know, I was just wondering because I'm probably kind of getting up there too. So
I think that folks who grew up in this neighborhood, some of whom were displaced. Many of those people that I work with were born in the 1920s and 30s, so mm-hmm. they are really quite elder, and they understood, they've accepted that. I usually privilege those sorts of voices. Those are the folks who have lived the richest experiences. So I know folks that lived through the 1930s, delivered papers in the neighborhood. One of the people I work with, Thomas Ridley, lives on Pecos Street now. Mm-hmm. He delivered papers here in the 30s. He landed on the beaches in Normandy. And then he came back to Indiana. He worked at the post office. Those are the voices that I think we have to privilege.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
They have long, they have this long view of what Black experience has been like in this place.
Those are definitely the voices that you want to hear from. Jordan, what resources do you think we can all check out so we can learn more about urban historic preservation here in central Indiana?
Yeah, for advocacy groups, I encourage everyone to check out Historic Urban Neighborhoods of Indianapolis. That's a group dedicated to improving quality of life issues for older Indianapolis neighborhoods. And Preserve Greater Indy, which is a group of younger-ish historic preservation professionals working in Indianapolis. Strong Indy is a great resource for issues surrounding urban planning and equity. And I also think our downtown historic housing stock is sort of at this intersection of future affordable housing policy. So I encourage everyone to check out Homes for All Indy, our community land trust initiative. And then for library resources, you can learn more about redlining at the website Mapping Inequality. And many of the archival materials I reference in my presentations are related to the Indianapolis Bicentennial Digital Collection, specifically the Department of Metropolitan Development Collection, which is available online.
You have a lot of work to showcase. A lot of work. As far as the research, too, is that available for the public to also check out?
Yes. Our upcoming article on Indiana Avenue is part of the Belt Anthology Series, which is part of the Indianapolis Bicentennial Celebration. It is available for pre-order via Belt Publishing.
Do you find that people are still hungry for this information, this history? Do you find that there's a lot of interest in history? Oh, we like to say yes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. People can be really shocked when you lay out this sort of timeline of white supremacist policies that kept chipping away at the neighborhood. And once you, add these layers of planning and zoning history on top of neighborhood development and growth, on top of historic preservation efforts and displacement efforts, it's a really complicated and busy picture to paint. But I'll keep trying to make sense of it so people realize that history repeats itself until we own up to our mistakes and missteps of those before us.
Do you have anything else coming up that you can share that you're working on?
Briefly. The Wilma Gibbs Moore Fellowship through Indiana Humanities, that was in reaction to the racial injustice we're finally acknowledging as a country. So Indiana Humanities put together this research fellowship to sort of add historic context to racial injustice. And I'm taking my redlining project a bit further with a project titled A Judgment Call, Indianapolis Redlining and Unjust Legacies. Mm-hmm. So I'll be sort of looking at the lingering questions I have, picking apart the Federal Housing Administration's policy.
All right. We'll look forward to that. Well, thank you both so much for taking the time today. We appreciate it. We're talking to Jordan Ryan, an Indianapolis-based architectural historian, and Paul Mullins, author and professor of anthropology at IUPUI. Again, thank you both for your time and your expertise today. I'm Taylor Bennett. Thanks so much for listening. This is All In.